Usually when you walk into a theater and see like a perfect, pristine living room on stage, there's this underlying expectation of comfort.
Oh, absolutely. We've been completely conditioned to expect that.
Right. It feels almost like stepping into a classic 1950s sitcom. You just sit back, the lights go down, and you naturally expect the characters to have these tidy little problems.
Right. Problems that get wrapped up nicely by the final curtain.
Exactly. But then you encounter the work of the playwright we are looking at today, and suddenly that pristine living room feels, well, like a cage.
It really does.
The floorboards are cracking open, the polite conversation just evaporates, and instead you find yourself watching an absolute psychological blood sport.
That is a very good way to put it.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. Just for you, we're using the extensive Wikipedia records on the life and work of Edward Albee as our map.
It's quite a map, too.
It really is. Our mission here is to look way beyond his most famous titles and unpack the turbulent, frankly fascinating life of the man who reinvented post-war American theater.
And we really have to look at the whole picture to understand him.
Yeah, we're going to explore how a rebellious adopted heir to a massive vaudeville fortune ended up systematically tearing down the American dream on stage.
It's a wild trajectory.
It is, and I have to say, looking at your background today, this incredibly atmospheric, dimly lit, book-lined Tribeca Loft vibe you've got going on, it really sets the perfect tone for where we're heading.
I mean, I try. It felt like the right environment. Albee himself actually lived in a massive Tribeca loft later in life, surrounded by art and
Oh,
books.
nice.
But, to understand how he ended up as this titan at American theater, constantly dissecting the modern condition, we can't start in a lofty Manhattan apartment.
Right, we have to go back.
Exactly. We
Right.
have to look at the very foundation of his life, specifically the family environment he spent so much energy running away from.
Okay, let's unpack this origin story because his early life feels like a novel in itself. To give you some context, he is born in 1928 in Washington, D.C. And at just 2 weeks old, his biological mother, Louise Harvey, places him for adoption. He's taken to Larchmont, New York, and adopted by a couple named Reed A. Albee and his wife, Frances.
And this is not just an average suburban family, not at all.
No, definitely not.
Reed Albee is the son of Edward Franklin Albee II, who was a literal vaudeville magnate.
Wait, like a massive theater empire?
Oh, yeah. We're talking about a family that owned a huge chain of theaters. And Frances, his adoptive mother, was a prominent socialite.
Wow.
So at 2 weeks old, this child is dropped into a world of extreme wealth, but also a world governed by rigid, almost suffocating social expectations. And of course, the constant pressure of performance.
You can almost picture the environment, right? The country clubs, formal dinners, a very specific path laid out for him.
Exactly.
And his academic record shows just how spectacularly he rejected that path. I mean, he gets expelled from the prestigious Lawrenceville School in New Jersey.
Right, which is a big deal.
Huge deal. So they try to straighten him out by sending him to Valley Forge Military Academy in Pennsylvania, and he is dismissed from there in under a year.
It just wasn't going to take.
No. He eventually lands at Trinity College in Connecticut, and by 1947, he gets expelled again. And the reason? Skipping classes and flat out refusing to attend compulsory chapel.
Yeah, and what you're seeing there isn't just a teenager lacking discipline. I mean,
Yeah.
it's a fundamental, almost allergic reaction to institutional conformity.
Like he physically couldn't do it.
Right. The military academy, the elite prep school, the compulsory chapel, these are the pillars of the traditional American establishment. And he was systematically dismantling his own participation in them.
I always think about it like a modern day heir to a massive tech empire rebelling by running off to join a punk band.
That's a great analogy.
Except Albee's version of a punk band was avant-garde literature, because by 1946, while he's busy failing out of these rigid institutions, he's already publishing poems, short stories, plays.
Yes.
He even wrote a 500-page novel called The Flesh of Unbelievers as a teenager.
Which completely changes the narrative of his rebellion, doesn't it?
It really does, a 500-page novel.
Right. It takes an immense amount of focus and dedication to write something that long at that age. It proves his refusal to conform wasn't just aimless laziness, it was a highly directed artistic energy.
He knew what he wanted.
Exactly. He was rejecting their world because he was already building his own.
So he leaves home for good at 18,
Wow.
and looking back on it later in life, he did not mince words. He described the environment as stultifying and suffocating.
Yeah, he's just very clear about that.
He even told Charlie Rose in an interview that he was essentially thrown out because his parents wanted him to be a corporate thug, and they completely disapproved of him wanting to be a writer.
That phrase, corporate thug, reveals everything about how he viewed the American dream of wealth and corporate ladder climbing.
It's so biting.
It is. By walking away from that fast vaudeville inheritance, he severs his ties to the establishment. But as a writer, that rejection becomes his greatest asset.
Oh, so?
Well, you can't critique the suffocating nature of high society expectations with such surgical precision unless you have felt trapped inside that specific cage yourself.
Oh, that makes total sense. So he leaves the corporate thug trajectory behind and drops right into the grit of Greenwich Village.
Quite the change of scenery.
Yeah, he takes on odd jobs just to survive. He rooms with the composer William Flanagan. And it seems like this immersion into a completely different, much harder reality is what fuels the explosive early period of his career.
It acts as an absolute catalyst. When scholars like the English professor Matthew Rudane analyze Albee's work, they usually look at this first era from about 1959 to 1966 as a period defined by gladiatorial confrontations.
Gladiatorial.
Yeah, the work is visceral. It's bloody action playing out through dialogue.
And the pace at which he was working is staggering. He writes his first play, The Zoo Story, in just 3 weeks.
3 weeks?
Right. And it's so unconventional that it actually has to premiere in Berlin in 1959 before it finally makes its way off Broadway in 1960.
America just wasn't ready for it yet.
Exactly. But then, of course, the absolute earthquake hits in 1962 with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh, yes. That is the play that permanently shifts the tectonic plates of American theater.
It opens on Broadway at the Billy Rose Theater, and it runs for 664 performances.
Which is wild.
It is. For a play that intense, that dark, a run that long is practically unheard of. It wins the Tony Award for Best Play, it wins a Grammy for Best Spoken Word Album, and it becomes a massive cultural flashpoint.
Absolutely.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. What really grabs my attention isn't the commercial success. It's the conflict it caused within the establishment itself.
You are referring to the 1963 Pulitzer Prize controversy.
I am.
Which might just be the most revealing moment of his early career.
It really is. So okay. The drama jury, the people actually tasked with evaluating the art, selected Virginia Woolf to win the Pulitzer.
As they should have.
But the advisory committee steps in, overrules the jury, and decides to give no award for drama at all that year because they deemed the play too controversial and too vulgar.
Just completely scrapped the award for the year.
Yes. Two members of the jury, John Mason Brown and John Gassner, actually resigned in protest. Like, what makes a play so threatening that an advisory board would rather cancel the award than give it to him?
What's fascinating here is that we have to look at the mechanics of what Albee was actually doing on stage. At the time, there was a major European movement called the Theater of the Absurd.
Right, like Samuel Beckett.
Exactly, Beckett or Eugene Ionesco.
Uh-huh.
Their work often focused on existential dread, the meaninglessness of life, and the breakdown of human communication.
Heavy stuff.
Very. But European absurdism was often set in abstract, barren landscapes. Albee's stroke of genius was taking that abstract existential dread and dropping it straight into a recognizable bourgeois American living room.
Oh, wow. So he takes the dread of a barren wasteland and puts it on a comfortable sofa with a cocktail in hand?
Precisely. He Americanized the absurd. He used this incredibly biting, weaponized dialogue to strip away the idealized post-war image of heterosexual marriage.
He was exposing the cracks.
Yeah, he was holding up a mirror to the American dream, showing the rot underneath the pristine surface. The Pulitzer board wasn't just offended by the language, they were horrified by the reflection.
Because they were the very establishment he was critiquing.
Exactly.
And the irony is just profound. A play deemed too vulgar for a Pulitzer in 1963 ends up being selected decades later by the Library of Congress for preservation in the National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
It's a huge vindication.
It really is. But, you know, when you begin your career at the absolute, undeniable pinnacle of cultural relevance, you are faced with a massive problem. Where do you go from there?
Right. For a true artist, the only direction is into uncharted, highly experimental territory, even if you know the audience might refuse to follow you.
Which ushers in this vast middle period of his career, spanning from the early 70s through the late 80s. And it starts off with incredible ambition. In 1971, he writes a play called All Over.
A very different kind of play.
Very different. The critic Clive Barnes described it as a formal minuet of death, noting that the dialogue was structured almost like operatic arias.
And that shift to the operatic is crucial. Albie wasn't interested in repeating the screaming matches of Virginia Woolf.
He'd already done that.
Right. He was becoming leaner, sparer, and much more philosophic in his approach. And for a moment, it still worked. In 1974, his play Seascape won him another Pulitzer Prize.
But then the tide turns dramatically. As he leans further into this philosophical experimentation, he starts alienating his core Broadway audience.
They just weren't on board.
The commercial theater crowd completely turns on him, and the absolute low point of this era seems to be 1983 with a play called The Man Who Had Three Arms.
Oh, yeah. That was a rough one.
The reception was brutal. Frank Rich of the New York Times just eviscerated it, writing that it isn't a play, it's a temper tantrum in two acts. The criticism was relentlessly harsh.
It was. Michael Billington, writing for The Guardian, made a fascinating observation about this period. He argued that American dramatists invariably end up as victims of their own myth.
Okay, but let me challenge that prevailing narrative for a second.
Sure.
Whenever we look back at an artist who had a massive early hit and then a string of critical failures, I always wonder, were plays like The Man Who Had Three Arms actually terrible pieces of theater? Or was the theater going public just punishing Albie because he refused to write Virginia Woolf Part 2?
I mean, that is the essential tension of the American cultural machine.
Yeah.
We live in a success-crazed culture. Failure to constantly replicate your early masterpiece is often treated not just as a disappointment, but as an unforgivable offense.
Like a betrayal.
Exactly. Yeah. Billington noted that Albie was suffering the exact same cruel fate as Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams. The audience demands familiar comfort, and Albie was explicitly offering them discomfort.
So facing this intense Broadway backlash, he does something highly strategic. He retreats.
Yes, he does.
He takes his work away from the harsh, unforgiving glare of the New York critics and starts premiering his plays in regional U.S. theaters and across Europe.
He had to find a sanctuary. He needed a space where he could keep pushing boundaries and experimenting with form, without the immediate pressure of box office survival.
And stepping out of that blinding spotlight allowed him to gather the emotional material necessary to confront his oldest demons. Which brings us to 1991 and what has to be one of the greatest late career comebacks in theater history.
It really is legendary.
He writes a play called Three Tall Women, which premieres in Vienna.
And this play eventually wins him his third Pulitzer Prize. But the mechanics of the story are what make it so deeply resonant.
Because it's so personal, right?
Incredibly. The main character is a nonagenarian, a woman in her 90s, and she is based directly on his adoptive mother, Frances.
The same socialite whose world he fled at 18.
The very same.
The play dives into her dementia, her regrets, her deep resentments. It is intensely, uncomfortably personal. It proved so enduring that decades later, in 2018, it won a Tony Award for Best Revival of a Play starring Glenda Jackson.
It's an absolute masterpiece.
But think about the poetic irony here for a second. The mother who drove him away, the environment he called suffocating, ultimately provides him with the exact material he needs to reclaim his throne in American theater at the age of 63.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the broader implication of this late period is how it serves as a masterclass in synthesis.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at Three Tall Women, or his later 2002 play The Goat, or Who is Sylvia, which won a Tony for Best Play, by the way,
yeah.
You see an artist operating at the peak of his powers.
Merging his styles.
Exactly. He took the visceral gladiatorial confrontations of his early work, and he seamlessly married them with the mature philosophical depth he forged during his difficult middle period.
It completely cemented his legacy. The New York Times ended up crowning him as widely considered to be the foremost American playwright of his generation.
He outlasted them all.
He literally outlasted the critics who told him he was finished, forcing them to reevaluate his entire canon.
Which is the ultimate revenge, really.
Seriously. But after exploring a lifetime of Albie dissecting other people's relationships on stage, we need to turn the lens on the man himself. Because his own identity and relationships offstage were incredibly complex.
They were. And the source material provides some crucial insights into his personal life. Albie stated that he first knew he was gay when he was 12 and a half years old.
Okay.
Yet his early relationships didn't necessarily fit a simple narrative. As a teenager, he had an intense relationship with a woman named Delphine Weisinger.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He escorted her to her coming out party and later said they were unofficially engaged. He was so integrated into her family that he called her mother Mummy, which actually caused a lot of friction with his own adoptive mother, Frances.
I can imagine. But as he moved into adulthood, his relationships aligned with his true identity.
Right.
During the 1950s, he had a relationship spanning several years with the playwright Terrence McNally, and then he found his life partner, the sculptor Jonathan Thomas.
Yes, and they were partners for 34 years.
34 years. From 1971 until Thomas tragically passed away from bladder cancer in 2005.
What becomes fascinating here is how Albee navigated the intersection of his personal identity and his public life as an artist.
Because he was very protective of that boundary.
Very. Throughout his career, his plays prominently featured characters that relentlessly challenge the traditional image of heterosexual marriage. Given his own 34-year same-sex partnership, many people naturally wanted to view his work through that specific LGBT lens.
But he fiercely rejected being pigeonholed. And we should be very precise about how he articulated this, because he addressed it directly in his acceptance speech for the 2011 Lambda Literary Foundation's Pioneer Award.
That's a very famous speech.
Yeah, he stood up and said, quote, "A writer who happens to be gay or lesbian must be able to transcend self. I am not a gay writer. I am a writer who happens to be gay."
That is a profound declaration regarding the function of art. He was drawing a very hard line between his personal demographic and his artistic output.
So what does this all mean? How do you interpret that tension? I pose this to you listening right now. How do we reconcile a playwright whose entire canon relentlessly dismantled the conventions of heterosexual marriage with a man who absolutely insisted he was not an LGBT advocate or a gay writer?
This raises an important question, and I think it comes down to his core philosophy about universal truth. Albee believed that if a writer fails to transcend self, the art becomes limited.
It gets boxed in.
Exactly. He believed that knowledge and art are most valuable when they speak to the universal human condition, rather than being confined to a single political agenda or demographic label.
That makes a lot of sense.
When he was tearing down the American Dream on stage, he wasn't doing it just to advocate for one specific community. He was dismantling it because he believed it was a suffocating, dangerous solution for everyone, regardless of who they were.
And he applied that same expansive, unconventional approach to how he lived his daily life. At the time of his death in 2016, at the age of 88, he wasn't living in some traditional estate.
No, not at all.
He was living in that massive 6,000 square foot former cheese warehouse in Tribeca that we talked about earlier. He filled this vast space with a tremendous collection of fine art, particularly focusing on indigenous artworks from Africa and Oceania.
And he also recognized how difficult the path of an artist truly is. And he took tangible steps to make it easier for those coming up behind him.
This might actually be my favorite detail about him. He took the immense royalties from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and used them to establish a foundation.
Which is amazing.
He funded a place called The Barn in Montauk, New York, specifically to give writers and visual artists a sanctuary to work without disturbance.
Who's paying it forward?
Exactly. He used the financial windfall from his most chaotic, aggressive play to buy other artists the quiet time and space that he fought so desperately to find for himself.
It proves that while he spent his career breaking down facades, he was also deeply committed to building structures that actually mattered.
Absolutely. For those of you listening, as you process all of these details from the source material, I want you to think about why Edward Albee's life matters to you today.
It's a very relevant story.
It is. Whether you are currently feeling trapped by the expectations of your environment, or maybe you are facing a mid-career slump where the world is telling you that you've lost your touch, or you are simply trying to define your own identity in a culture that desperately wants to put a convenient label on you, Albee's journey offers a powerful blueprint.
It really does.
It proves that stubbornly refusing to conform and being willing to endure the wilderness of unpopularity can eventually force the entire world to catch up to you.
He refused to apologize for exposing the cracked floorboards. He simply kept pointing out what was underneath until everyone else was finally brave enough to look.
But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over today. Something that wasn't explicitly discussed in the source material we covered.
Okay, let's hear it.
Edward Albee spent his entire life delivering a blistering, uncompromising critique of the American dream. But over time, his plays became heavily awarded, meticulously studied, and ultimately formed a core pillar of the American theatrical canon.
Right.
So did he, ironically, become the very establishment he originally sought to dismantle? Did the young rebel who broke the floorboards of the American living room eventually become the very foundation he sought to destroy? It is something to think about the next time you take a seat in the theater and the lights go down.
That is quite the paradox to ponder. Thank you for joining us as we unpacked the extraordinary life of Edward Albee.
We'll see you on the next deep dive. Keep questioning the script.